I trust you all watch with regularity, called 30 Rock. I doubt you all watch it. It doesn't matter if you watch it, but it is a show that is inane, but it is funny. And there's a character named Tracy Jordan who is the apex of the show's inanity, a man who once lamented that he only had $300 million. He's the sort of prima donna, the big talent on this fictitious show. And in one episode, he comes back to his high school, the high school from which he never graduated, but now to which he comes as an accomplished star of ridiculous movies. And he gives this speech as he gives his gratitude for having received an honorary diploma from this high school. And he says this to the expectant students who are in the audience. He looks at them with all earnestness and seriousness and says, "If you'll just be yourself, I'm a living proof of this. If you'll just be yourself, I guarantee you," he says, "if you'll just be yourself, I guarantee you that every single one of you will become president of the United States." And they're not sure what to make of it. It's hilarious because it's ridiculous. It's hilarious because he's lampooning something. He's lampooning the idea that everyone can do everything. The idea that we've bought into that actually winds up paralyzing us and making us perennially restless in the work that we do and the relationships that we're in, that says this: you're destined for great things. You can do anything that you put your mind to. Well, because of an admixture of restlessness and those kinds of messages to us and our ambitions to do great things, it makes it very impossible sometimes for us to even get on in the world, for us to give ourselves to any work that God might call us to or any relationships that He might bring us in. We find ourselves in a way like a favorite character of mine in one of Walker Percy's novels called The Last Gentleman. His name is Will Barrett. Maybe I've shared this before, but he says this about Will Barrett. He says, after this morning's, "For until this moment," Will Barrett, who had just seen a girl drop a note on a park bench as he spied her through a telescope, his life had come to such a pass that he attached significance to this thing he had seen. "For until this moment, he had lived in a state of pure possibility, not knowing what sort of man he was or what he must do, and supposing, therefore, that he must be all men and he must do everything. But after this morning's incident, his life took a turn in a particular direction. Thereafter, he came to see that he was not destined to do everything, but only one or two things. Lucky is the man who does not secretly believe that every possibility is open to him." Lucky is the man who does not secretly believe that every possibility is open to him. Lucky is the man who doesn't secretly believe that we're all going to become president of the United States. The reformers, folks like Calvin and Luther, in reckoning with this idea that God has created us in His image, that we help carry out His providential care, the way He governs the minutes and molecules and the universe in a magnificent way through the service of His people, they realize that an important doctrine or an important way for us to see our work is that we have been positioned in certain places at certain times with certain abilities and certain opportunities to use them that constitute what's called a calling. Calvin, not Ball, whose company is doing a great job with our renovations here, but John Calvin, said this: "Finally, this point is to be noted. The Lord bids each one of us in all life's actions to look to His calling. For He knows with what great restlessness human nature flames. With what fickleness it is borne hither and thither. When was the last time you used hither and thither? Here and there. See, Calvin didn't even have the internet or a television. They didn't have the capacity to fly around the world. He didn't have any line of credit where he could buy cool stuff. There wasn't even that much cool stuff to buy. And yet he could say, 500 years ago, he knows with what great restlessness human nature flames, with what fickleness it is born here and there, how its ambition longs to embrace various things at once. There's something about us that makes us like a kid who enters into a carnival and there's so much going on, you don't even know where to start. You want to do everything all at once, and so you want to do nothing. And that's part of how we're constituted, he says. And so therefore, lest through our, and Calvin had gentle ways of putting things, through our stupidity and rashness, everything be turned topsy-turvy, or you could say cattywampus, he has appointed duties for every man in his, or woman, in his particular way of life. And that no one may thoughtlessly transgress his limits, he has named these various kinds of livings callings. Therefore, each individual has his own kind of living assigned to him by the Lord as a sort of sentry post, so that he may not heedlessly wander about throughout life. From this will also arise a singular consolation. No task will be so sordid and so base, provided you obey your calling in it, that it will not shine and be reckoned very precious in God's sight. Calvin says, you know, one of the great gifts of God for people who are restless, for people who change our minds daily about what we want or what we think we want or what we're sure we need, for people who want everything all at once, who are therefore tempted to commit themselves to nothing, to wander about in life, he actually, by the way he's configured us and the times that we live and the families that we're born to and the gifts that we've got and the opportunities that he opens our way, has assigned us ways of living called callings. And as we look at the passage that Dave read from Exodus, I'd like to suggest this as a thesis that hopefully I'll repeat some for you today. I'll put this as simple as possible. That it helps cut through the difficulties of a lot of the decisions that we have. It helps as sort of a bit in the mouth of our desires to yank us back into the times and places where we are, to realize that we're called to serve God where we are with what we've got. Isn't that a profound statement? You're called to serve God where you are with what you've got. And you can do this with the confidence that your actual work, not your potential work, your actual work, not the work that you might be doing, both paid and unpaid, because all work, as we've said last week, doesn't have a paycheck, is the primary and best way for you to serve God in the world. You serve God where you are with what you've got. And you can do it with this confidence that this actual work, whether it's paid or unpaid, is the primary and best way for you to serve God and the world. When you look at this passage, when God has it in mind to set up a physical spot in the camp where the Israelites can come to meet with him and to worship with him and make their sacrifices, he has this ornate tabernacle that's to be built. And one of the things that's interesting as you look at it is that God has created this opportunity for his people to respond to something. And the refrain throughout is everyone who was willing and whose heart moved them, they brought what they had. Every skilled woman spun with her hands and brought what she had spun. Blue, purple, or scarlet yarn, or fine linens, not lemons. And all the women who were willing and had the skill spun the goat hair. I'm assuming that most of you have not done any goat hair spinning this morning. If you had, I would love to confer with you as to why. But it is interesting to note that God provides this opportunity, and these women have a willingness in the face of the opportunity and the need, and they have these skills in order to meet this opportunity and need. And these things converge, and for that time, in that work, that was their calling. Frederick Buechner has said about our calling, it's the place where God has your deep gladness coincide with the world's deep hunger. It's this recognition that calling is never a unilateral thing. It's not just considered on one side of it. It's not just you and God. It's always about God and you and your desires and abilities that He's given you, and then the needs of the world. And where those things coincide, you find yourself at the intersection of God's calling in your life. And the way Tim Keller says it, and we're going to use this as scaffolding for today's sermon, as we think about how we serve God, where we are with what we've got. As he said, there are three things you ought to look at, and I think we see them in this passage in Exodus. Is you ought to look at your affinity, your ability, and your opportunity. These all end in I-T-Y. Affinity, ability, and opportunity. First, affinity. One of the things you notice here is that all the people who are pitching in for the work of the tabernacle, they all have a desire to do so. Their hearts move them. They're willing. When you're starting to try to figure out what your work is in the world, and you're bombarded with all kinds of needs and all kinds of possibilities, one of the things that you pay attention to is, what things pop out at you? What things do you notice? What things reverberate and cause resonance in your heart? There are some of you in here that you hear this little baby crying right now that Drew's attending to so wonderfully. What a good dad. And some of you are saying, oh, comfort that baby. Oh, what a good dad, Drew. And some of you are saying, shut that baby up. I don't like babies. Because Drew set this thing up well for me. Because you have certain affinities. Some of you love children. Some of you tolerate children. But you're moved when you see the needs of children, for instance, and that's something you ought to pay attention to. It says something about you. Some of you are recognizing that people need employment. You have an inward desire to create things. You have artistic ability. You have a desire to use your hands to make something. Or you want to create jobs so that people can have work. You have a knack for making money. You have an affinity within you that coincides with things that you see out in the world. And that's not insignificant. It was interesting to me the other night in my small group, I started with a icebreaker. Just to get people talking to each other. I did not tell them that this is what we were doing. I just did. But I asked them, what was your least favorite job you ever had? It was a great question, if I might say so. It was great because of what it generated by way of conversation, getting to listen to people talk about their most hated jobs. And even though it was a statistically small sampling, like 62% of the people had food service in their worst job ever. So there aren't a lot of people aspiring to work at Hardee's later, because they worked there before and they realized how bad it was, and it cured them from ever wanting to eat there again. Well, what was interesting to me, though, is the fact that you heard people talk about how terrible it was to have to work in the food service industry, and at the same time, you'd hear somebody say, I love food service. And you could say, well, God bless you. Because the wonder of it is that God has made you. He has fashioned you. You have desires. You notice certain things. You gravitate towards certain things. You see certain things that need to be done in the world. And you feel compelled to do something about it. That's something. That's something that God, who whose the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. He directs it like a waterway wherever he will. He's directing your desires and your heart as well. So whenever you find needs popping out and you have a desire to meet them, that's something that's significant when you're determining what your work is. And it's very possible that some of the things that you hear about and you just get filled with dread. Oh, gosh. I guess God's calling me to work with teenagers. Purgatory right now on earth. And it's highly likely that no, he's not. You're off the hook. Because there are actually people. There are at least three of them in here who want to work with teenagers. This odd species of human, God has generated sympathy and love in some people's hearts for them. Just kidding, teenagers. I love teenagers. But I'm not called to work with them. All right. So, affinity. You look at your affinity. Where is your desire? What does that say to you? The second thing you look at is your ability. What do you have? What are you able to do? All of the people that were participating in the work of the tabernacle, they had skills. All the Israelite men and women who were willing brought to the Lord freewill offerings. And Moses said to the Israelites, "See, the Lord has chosen Bezaleel, son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah, and he has filled him with the Spirit of God, with skill, ability, and knowledge in all kinds of crafts, to make artistic designs for work in gold, silver, and bronze, to cut and set stones, to work in wood, to engage in all kinds of artistic craftsmanship." The reason I've selected this passage, I did select it alongside the Corinthians passage where Paul talks about to each one a manifestation of the Spirit has been given for the common good, that everybody has a gift. Everybody in whom God takes up residence has things to offer. But we tend to think of that only in spiritual terms. And I think if you start to get a more robust sense that this world that you inhabit is a world that God is maintaining and preserving every single second of every single day and night. And part of what he has done is entrusted you. Now, as you're being recreated into his image and in whom the Spirit of God lives, he's entrusted you to help him care for the world, to provide for the needs of people, to make sure that people have things to eat, that people have employment, that children are cared for, that the sick are tended to in hospitals, that people are educated, that people have ways to do leisure and to relax and to get refreshed, that people have beautiful things to look at, to have windows into the wonder of who God is, then you realize that the Spirit of God, as God brokers his authority and his responsibility to you, it's not just spiritual stuff. If you know how to do something good, who made you like that? Just to be technical about it. There are people in here who really do. We got a lot of them who know how to, well, they know how to make things. They know how to paint in magnificent ways. They know how to use words really excellently. They know so much about caring for children. Some of you know how to make money. Some of you love animals. Do you realize that God has configured you like this? That these abilities are not accidents. These skills that you have, whether they're in a helping profession or whether they're in some kind of business or law, these are things that God has made you able to do because he wants to help make his presence known in those industries, in those places. And so when you're trying to figure out what your work is, you start to ask, what am I good at? What can I do? What do I have? Theologians have normally said that in the Scriptures it seems to be the case that a gift often constitutes a calling. It's at least part of it. If you're really good at something, it's very likely that God wants you not to not use it. That's two double negatives. Like a little kid the other day told me after a soccer game, "Hey, did you win your soccer game?" He said, "We always never win." I love the way of saying that. We always never win. Well, God, if He has given you some capacity to make a landscape beautiful or to create a business that causes employment and generates wealth, or to make a painting or a score of music or to teach people things, if God has made you with a capacity to do that, it is highly likely that He wants you to do that. So don't ignore it. But don't try to determine it by yourself. There are a number of things in the world that one should not do by themselves. And one of them is you should not determine your calling by yourself. You shouldn't determine your work by yourself. You shouldn't determine what your gifts are by yourself. We sometimes have this idea that we determine our spiritual gifts or our capacities and abilities and talents for work in the world. We think we can fill out a questionnaire. We can just have some moments of reflection. And then we can come up with it. But in reality, of course, there's a whole lot of the talents and abilities that you have that you don't even know you have, or you're not sure that you have, until someone else notices them. Until someone else calls them out. We're often the last to know. When you're sitting at a table and you're eating and enjoying the chocolate cake and there's half of it on the side of your face, everybody at the table knows except for who? You! You're the last to know! And the same is true for a lot of your gifts and abilities. You don't necessarily know. You're not necessarily in a position to gauge best what you do best by yourself. You know, it's interesting that I read this book with a group of friends called Listening to Your Life, or Listen to Your Life, and the guy's name is Parker Palmer, is that right? Something like that. It has a lot of P's in it. Parker Palmer, and Parker Palmer, which is easy to say, there's a nursery rhyme about this, isn't there? Peter Piper, pick to pick. And he is a Quaker and a professor. Those two things don't always go together. But he said that a certain juncture in his life, he'd always dreamed of being a college president. And he was a professor, though. And he taught, and an opportunity came available for him to become considered for the presidency of a college. And being in the Quaker tradition, they had this great sort of informal institution called a clearness committee, whereby you'd get some people in the church who were wise, who were known to be in touch with God, who were perceptive and attentive, and you would sit before them, and you would, when you had big decisions to make about your life, they would ask you questions. And you try to answer their questions, and hopefully together, in a communal sort of way, not just by yourself, it would emerge to you what ought to be happening. And as they begin to ask him questions about the presidency of this college that he was being considered for, something happened to him. It became very clear to him that the only thing about being a college president that he wanted was to have a picture of himself in the newspaper that said, Parker Palmer, president. And he was just honest enough to say that out loud. Nobody in here would have any ambition to have their name in print or to acquire any sort of fame or recognition for something, would they? Nobody in here would go after a job just because of the money that it would give, even though they're not suited for it, or just because of the acclaim they would get, just because they're, even though they're not suited for it. I realize I'm not talking to anybody here. But he started to realize, you know what? I'm a teacher. I love my discipline. I love teaching students. I love interacting with students. I love it when they understand what's going on. I don't love being a fundraiser or a vision caster or an administrator, which is a lot of what a college president would do. Why would I be a college president? But he couldn't figure it out by himself. By himself, he was duped. He needed others to help him figure out what his abilities were. You look at your affinity when you want to determine your work. You look at your ability. What do you have? Normally a gift constitutes a calling. It's something to be used for other people, not to be wasted, not to be sat on. And one of the things that none of you think about generally when it comes to your abilities, but I want to point it out to you, especially if you're over the age of 40, which means about 8 of you. It's a joke. But you know what? It occurs to me often in our church when I'm with the people who are over 40 and 50 and 60 and 70. We even have some over 70. Is that one of the things that you've been entrusted with that's part of your calling is your suffering. I don't know that you think of it that way, but some of the best things that you have to offer to the world are the ways that you've seen God show up when everything was dark. The ways you've seen Him interact in your marriage when it was about to fall apart. The ways that you've seen Him see you through when you were so confused and disoriented and things were so filled with despair. All of you in here have been entrusted with certain kinds of suffering, and I guarantee you, according to the Apostle Paul, that if you got any comfort from it, part of that comfort is so you can share it with other people. That's part of your calling. Part of the work that you're called to do. Your affinity, your ability, and lastly, your opportunities. You look at what pops out at you. What are your desires, your affinity? You look at your abilities. What am I able to do? And then you lastly look at your opportunities. What is presented to me? What doors are opening for me? In this particular case in Exodus, there is a mandate. We need a tabernacle built. And people have an opportunity to respond. One of the great comforts of helping you not to live in a state of pure possibility, of helping you not to be paralyzed by the thought that you could do anything. How do I know if I'm supposed to work here, or in Manhattan, or in Indonesia, or in China, or in Uganda? How do I know? Well, if you think you might should live in those places, you could try to live there and see if you can. See if an opportunity opens up. See if providence moves in that way. See, one of the great comforts for a Christian is realizing that the future is not in your hands. Your decisions are quite meaningful. They do matter. They can bring reward. They can bring disaster. But they're not the end game. God's controlling the future. God's moving the pieces. God can turn even the bad things into good things. And I guarantee you this, if you ask any of those people over 40 in here who are now in relationships, who are now working at some work or another, if you said, when you were 22 years old, did you envision that you would be spending your life doing the thing that you spend most of your life doing now? I bet everybody in here, well, there'd be like four people that would say, I'm doing exactly what I knew I was going to do ever since I was in the fourth grade. Most people look back, so it seems to me, and they say, wow, I can see God's hand. I can see that God has opened doors for me. I can see that a calling has emerged for me, and it might change in certain seasons of life. There might be certain events that make a drastic change that needs to happen. But it's the opportunities that help you not live in a state of pure possibility. I could sit around because I'm such an amazing athlete and I could think, why am I not playing for the Braves? I could help them collapse in the last month of the season like they did. But you know, the Braves have never given me an opportunity to play for them. That shows their short-sightedness. But I can rule that out. I'm not meant to be a Major League Baseball player because I've never had the opportunity. There's nothing in my life. Well, and I don't have the ability either. And I don't really have the desire anymore. So that's a good call. It's ruled out. It's a great comfort, though, if you start to realize, you know, God really is upholding the world all the time. And He really does deeply care about you representing Him. He cares about human flourishing. That's why He sent His Son. So that this world that started out so good, so magnificent, and then got derailed and tarnished and vandalized, can now be again to start being put back together. He's made the church, these people in whom his presence has now animating, so that we can go out into the world and show people what work is for. Not just being ruled by money, or not just being ruled by some desire to get to our leisure, but some desire to broker God's care and his concern for the world in which we live. I promise you, if you look at your affinities, your abilities, and your opportunities, it will help you to realize that you serve God where you are with what you've got, and you can do it with great confidence. And I close with this because I think it's helpful to know. A lot of you are in situations where you're trying to figure out what's next. And a lot of you are eager and desirous that God might somehow or another show you, maybe skywrite it. That would be nice. Maybe let you know in very specific terms, leave you a voicemail or something, at least a text to say what you're supposed to do next. And of course, he is not nearly as cooperative in that regard as you think. Well, what if, as Keller says, guidance isn't so much something God gives, but something that he does? What if you could look back over your life as you pray, as you daily get renewed in your calling? Jesus, my first calling is to you. I'm called to belong to you. You know better than I do what I'm supposed to be doing today. Get me in the right spots. Form the right character in me so that I can be aware of how you want to care for people in my work and in my play and in my relational life. Show me these things. And you know what I find, and I imagine a lot of you have found it as well. When you look back, you can say, wow, look how God has guided me. But when I look forward, I never know. I don't ever get to move forward without some amount of faith. Perhaps God's calling you to the same kind of faith. The faith that on the other side of all that you're wondering about is a Savior who loved you so much that he gave himself up, that you might be brought to God, and now his Spirit lives in you, and he has purposes for you, he has intentions for you, and he's working out everything in conformity with the purpose of that will. So you can serve him where you are, with what you've got, in your actual work, not some imaginary one. Let's pray.